Anyway, history is interesting because, in many ways, really through the, particularly in the, what, from about the 5th to the 11th century, Buddhism was huge. It went up into Russia and through part of Persia and down into Afghanistan. And through Indonesia and Southeast Asia. And I always kind of refer to this because it is a phenomenal thing that actually not very many people ever visit. And it's on the island of Java in Indonesia, which is, of course, the largest Muslim country in the world, as far as population goes. And in the center of Java, there's kind of a ring of volcanoes. And I'm not sure what year, maybe 1890 or something like that. It was a valley with all these, rice fields that were there, and a couple of rivers running through it. And there was a hill that no one knew anything about. And there were actually palm trees kind of growing out of it. And some French archaeologist, heard this story, that somehow there had been something there before. And so, just as they did, that you probably know Angkor Wat in Cambodia, in Siem Reap, which is kind of well publicized, but Phop Dor is not so much. And yet, it's the largest really Buddhist monument or stupa, chetty in the world. And it was built in the 7th century. But what's interesting about it is it became this pilgrimage place where thousands from India, from China, Southeast Asia, would take ships and go on pilgrimage. In a sense, they say the Tibetans are phenomenal people. And sometimes their life is just really seems to be based on pilgrimage. That somehow if they go and part of it is the journey itself, So there's this big place, and they kind of, the World Heritage people, and they kind of uncovered, and they found it was out of lava stone. It had the life of the Buddha. It's huge, I don't know, 7 stories or something like that. And if you ever have the chance, check it out, But really, what I wanted to talk about tonight was the fact that, as the pilgrimage was always, there was kind of a process you had to go through. And one of the things was there's kind of the first temple, which has kind of these kind of angels on it, and it has huge, maybe 40-foot seated Maitreya, which is actually the coming Buddha. So you start at this place is where of Maitreya, that there is a future. And then there's this kind of wall. You go through the kind of jungles over river twice, and there's a very innocuous temple that's there before you reach Borobudur. And the little bit I understood of what they were saying was that. And you go there today, you see all these flowers and kind of urns of ashes of people and stuff. But the reference was that it was kind of the temple of toxins, and that somehow that part of this pilgrimage, this process that we all kind of go through as we come up to. In a sense, our kind of difficulties that somehow, they hold us. And They are not something that will stop you from going, but it's something that you have to, in the sense they talk about it as a purification process, that there's something has to be, you have to go there to let go of something. And in a way, these retreats, to me, are fundamental pilgrimages. You know, you come here, you bring whatever's going on in your life, and you kind of settle in, and then what happens? You know, sometimes 40 years ago, from whatever, you know, stuff starts coming in, you know? And if you're really good, you just kind of, you know, kind of bow to it and say, cool, and go on to the next thing. But the thing is, they have hooks, you know? And they grab us, and then we sort of go on this little journey, you know? And part of that journey is really this thing of Borobudur, is where this temple of toxins, it's where somehow, it's some place where you leave some problems, something you're holding, some emotion, which is kind of how it happens, you know? And here I always think, you know, I suspect you think the person next to you is really together and quiet and you know, and you're the only one fidgeting, you know. But actually, you know, we have that, that's a kind of illusion, okay? And so, and also part of our belief system is that, you know, they can sit here, but me, I just fidget, you know. But the truth is, this particular configuration and arena, you'd think is, oh, love and light. But actually, this is just a dump, you know? And so, you know, we're here kind of dumping stuff, you know? And so, in a way, it's why they talk about it as a purification. Something has to be purified. Well, guess what? It's those kind of stories and, you know, all those different feelings about so-and-so said this or that, or some family system. We carry a lot of stuff, you know. And it's not that you're going to solve it here, by the way. That's not what I'm talking about. I'm talking about that there is a process of, really, it is kind of feeling your way through it, you know. And so prior to really this like seven story, you know, it's like carved in all these seven levels are different stories of the Buddha, and I mean, and the thing was volcanoes, how it got covered years and years ago was the ashes from the volcanoes created the mountain, you know, and kind of covered it, and then everybody, you know, forgot about it. So we're here, we're kind of sitting here, and we think, oh, well, you know, you don't have to solve anything here, you know, but you do have to teach yourself to let go. You know, and maybe that's the wrong term, but at least you have to sit there and use that awareness to recognize the different feelings that are stimulated by those particular sometimes sensations, but usually it can be a memory or some kind of what is it? You get into a dialogue with someone or a monologue. And it's not that, it would be wonderful to say you didn't do it. You okay? But the truth is, it's actually part of this kind of untangling that has to happen. Traditionally, in the kind of system here that this kind of this visiting the temple of toxins, is really, it's based on what the Buddha in his last night, when he had made the resolve to sit under the Bo tree and not get up until he was fully awake. But in part of that process, and this is the human condition, they say he was visited by what is known as the 10 Maras, you know. And these were, you know, part of it was seduction, part of it was, you know, they talk about it as, you know, from the outside his own mind attacked him. So I'd like to, there are 10 maras, but I want to kind of go through four of them, which are kind of pivotal pieces of identification with kind of unskilled states and our capacity by knowing them to let go of them. So the first one, it's just simply called Devaputra Mara. And do you know what a deva is? You know, it's kind of, it translates as angel, you know? So in essence, and it's a mara, it means that somehow that we are seduced. And you can say it's by the pleasant, you know, the Devaputra. And it's all based on a thing called attachment. And so when we find ourselves, whether it's a story, a sensation, a memory, a plan, that there is attachment there, then you kind of enter the world of the Devaputra Mara. So one of the distinctions here, one of the things we're actually, this is the subtlety of what we're trying to learn here with Devaputra Mara, is that, of course, there, and we love this, we have pleasant sensations. They are due to causes and conditions. They come, they're there for a certain period of time, and they disappear. Now, a really, I can say, awake person would simply note, oh, pleasant. And if they were, you know, kind of promised, okay, you've got 10 pleasant moments, you know. And so, actually, awake person would enjoy all 10 moments. Right? But this Devaputra, this Mara, actually is something different. And this is something you're going to have to learn sitting here. And it's the difference between pleasant and wanting. So traditionally what happens to us, not those of us not so enlightened, is that after about 3 moments of pleasantness, we go, ooh, I like this. And the next thing you know, instead of kind of staying in yourself and recognizing, oh, this is pleasant, I like this, this is good, okay, this is what I'm getting right now, I understand it also is something that arises and passes due to conditions, it's okay. But then there is wanting. And wanting is this Devaputra Mara. It actually kind of leans into the pleasant. And actually really formulates a different state. And that state is wanting. And it's actually leaning out of the present. You know? So it's kind of, it tricks us, you know, and thinking, oh, you know, maybe I can, you know, duplicate this or, Maybe I can, you know, make maybe even better, more pleasure, you know? And so we kind of go into this state of wanting. Again, the problem is not the object of desire, but the energy in the mind. The energy of desire to keep us moving, looking for that thing that is really going to do it for us. The wanting mind is in itself, is painful. It is a self-perpetuating habit that does not allow us to be where we are because we are grasping for something somewhere else. Even when we get what we want, we then want something more or different because the habit of wanting is so strong. It is a sense that being here and now, and this is the thing, being here and now is not enough. You got that? Yeah. And so you're going to have to work with this one, though, because it's almost as if saying, you know, if you talk about aversion and anger, which are strong states, they're obvious. But this difference between pleasantness and wanting is much more subtle, and each of you will, you know, what is it? It's Mara. You get fooled, you know? And when you get fooled, you suffer, you know? So that's really, I just want to go through these. So the second of these Maras is there's the word skanda or kanda. And it is known as the components of being. And again, you may think this rather simplistic, but from a Buddhist point of view, when we are such complicated beings, but it's really kind of simple. So there are five khandhas or skandhas, and the first one is, you could say, is form or body. The second one, you know, is feeling. The third one is perception. And perception sometimes is kind of like, it's the first knowing of something. So it's kind of linked into memory. But there's no, perception is, there's no reactivity whatsoever. There's simply the knowing of the object or knowing of the feeling of what it is. So, and that's kind of, in a sense, it's kind of pure perception. And then the fourth of these is the thing called mental formations. You know what that one is? You know, it's, we make up all sorts of things about everything, you know. And that those mental formations, which are, you know, pure perception actually has, it has no judgment or anything in it. Mental formations is kind of the of human condition, is the, you know, it's the crux of what happens. So the fifth of these is just simply consciousness. And in this particular terminology, a consciousness is simply, you know, you could see it as, like the description of if you're looking at a candle, and first of all, there is the wax of the candle that's being reignited, and you look at it from a distance, it looks fairly solid. But if you get up close to it, you can see that it's thousands of moments of taking the wax and reigniting itself over and over and over again. And so that is kind of one of the descriptions of consciousness. Consciousness is something that arises due to conditions of being born, and that it then, in its igniting, what does it ignite? You know, well, it's this capacity to recognize. So we recognize, oh, you know, there is seeing, smelling, tasting, hearing, and these are all kind of what is fueling the whole system. You know, so these five khandhas or skandhas: the body, perception, mental, feeling,
perception,
mental formations, you know, and consciousness. So those are kind of the five, you know, it's simple components. But the peace when you get to consciousness and this reigniting, it's very interesting, because that's where the mind that we know is actually constantly the flickering of that consciousness. And I don't know why. You know, one moment you're sitting there and you're thinking about something. And the next moment you're actually seeing. And then maybe there's a smell. And then there's another thought. And then there's a memory. So it is constantly jumping from object to object. You know. And they say, and this is kind of the southern Buddhist view of it, is that it arises when you're born, and it will die when you die. So it is also a temporary process that is recognized. Really, a lot of these khandhas or skandhas, they are based on the fact that we are caught and attached to everything that, and particularly of life and the sense doors, and of course our memories, our perceptions, our feelings. And in a way, so those are just components, you know. But their nature is that they are also suffering. You know. And then you come to the kind of the third one, which is it's called klesha, klesha, and that has to do with the feelings. That second one, form, feeling. And that is to do with the feelings. And feelings, really, they also talk about them as the poisons, as greed, hatred, and delusion are the kind of the pushing forces behind them. So we find ourselves, you know, once we kind of acknowledge feeling, that they can be caught. And the Mara is kind of the negative force of it in these states, you know. So one of the things about that's true about the skandhas is one of the things that's attached to it is self. And that self is kind of the igniter of the feelings, you know. So, in some fashion, when we recognize that the it's kind of like the khandhas, what are they held by? They're pretty simple. They're held by a sense of me. And so whenever that's disturbed, it's kind of like it pulls the rug out of it. And then it ignites, you could say, the poisons of the klesas, you know. I hope that doesn't happen to you, but, you know. the truth is, you know, it does happen. And a lot of this is simply I talked a lot about the body last night, that these greed, hatred, delusion, which actually come from what? From pleasant, unpleasant, and spaced out. It's really kind of what it is. But when we recognize the pleasantness and we are attached to it, then we fall into this category of the klesa, of the mara, the actual negative side of that. And one of the things we have a tendency to do is, you're going along really just fine, sitting there very quiet, and then, you have a memory of, so-and-so, who done you wrong, or whatever, And the next thing you know, there is a reaction to that old story, which you probably worked in therapy for years over. And here it comes kind of along and kind of catches you. And this is, think about feelings in this klesa. Klesa is that it would be great if you had the wherewithal to be mindful and go, okay, that's fine, okay, adios. But what happens is we bring out a little can of gasoline, and we pour it on the story. And the next thing, it ignites. And you can spend a day and a half here, on some stupid story, and it's all about the feeling, this kind of, this mara, this, mara, they call it, also translates as the tempter, So suddenly you are caught in this tempting, and you're rewriting history. So it's really, it's important for, this is why we talk about being aware of something, is that when these feelings come, and just to know that all the feelings, all the klesas, which are all, in a sense, seductions on some level, so we fall for it, and then we actually support it, And the idea here is through the practice of mindfulness, and this is kind of the awareness, you can actually, it's sometimes when there's a strong feeling behind it, and I said this the other morning, I think, it's not like you can kind of go, I'll go back to the breath. And in a sense, you can kind of leave it, I'll say, leave it for a moment. But when it has a lot of power to it, then it will simply come back again, And if you don't pour gasoline on it, it's still going to, because it's a feeling, it's going to take a little time to unpack itself. And our process here is that when that kind of begins to repeat itself, and this goes back to last night, is all feelings, are based on a physical, actually, place. And there's usually an identifiable contraction somewhere. They say sometimes when you're sitting there and you go into a kind of a hypnagogic state, there's marvelous things sometimes. Meditation is kind of fascinating. Images and people and things go by, but you don't identify with them. But the moment you do, then there is somewhere, there is a reaction in the body, which is why we kind of put attention there, because that reaction in the body then can easily then be inflamed, or gasoline is another word for it. Anyway, it can turn into a bonfire, so these are just, they're tricky. Because, in a sense, those feelings, we have to, it's not like you can just, get rid of them and just say, I'm dumping them here and that's it. It's gone. It's not. It's going to take you on a little journey. But the dance between the breath, the body, and the mindfulness, it gives you kind of the tools to begin this process of really untangling them. You don't have to do anything with them. The problem is you add more to them, and that's not the idea. The idea here is just, you know, to be awake and aware to them and realize it's fine to dump them here, by the way. It's not going to harm anybody. And then at some point, there is a sense of, oh, relief. And sometimes you can take really old stories here, you know, and you think, oh, I'll never get rid of this, you know. But it's actually not true. You know? You can actually release and relieve just through, again, the willingness to kind of, I could say, kind of feel your way through it, you know. And not, you know, it's not about the story. It's not about the memory. It's about the physical feeling, you know. And that feeling goes back to, you know, greed or hatred, you know. It goes to where I'm going to reject it or I'm going to attach to it. And if we start doing that, then the Mara, it no longer, it's like disempowering it on some level. So the fourth of these Maras, it's called Yama. And Yama simply means death. It's not a great subject. But anyway, we have to actually recognize one thing. We're all unconscious when it comes to the fact that, you know, you're going to die. You know? And so a lot of times we get, like Susan, we get these messengers that come and inform us that, no, we are not permanent. You know? And that we have to, in a sense, kind of come more and more to terms with our mortality. You know, this is you know, one way journey. You know, and what the Mara is the unconsciousness. These practices, in many ways, I think, are based on the fact that if we really practice, that we're actually practicing to die. No, that sounds a little heavy, but it's true though, because every moment that you sit there, and whether you don't put gasoline, you don't put gasoline on some story or some feeling or whatever, when you don't do that, then there is, you know, there is this level of you know, of what? A freedom from, you know. I was going to say, I hope you don't die. You know? Is that stupid? You know, but the truth is, this is kind of that's the Mara. Is, oh, you know, no, not me, not going to happen. No. And then it comes and we go, oh my gosh. So in a sense, there's part of just, you know, as Mara, it's just unconsciousness. Through the practice, every time, you know, you recognize a contraction and you're in your body and you release it, you're beginning this process of waking up to the inevitable, you know. And maybe it's just that maybe it comes around, maybe there'll be less suffering, I don't know. I haven't died yet, so I don't know exactly how this is going to work. But I know that the training is basic here. It's like, okay, If these maras exist, and I really understand, you know, the power of that. Really, the khanda is really about me and I and me and mine. And somehow, that grasping of self, and that the klesa is about our feeling base and our confusion around pleasant and unpleasantness, and how we learn to grasp and attach to different feelings and stories, you know. And Yama, I don't know what to say about it, you know, except for you're working on it, you know. And I just believe every time that there's a moment where you, in a sense, are training yourself to let go. You know, maybe that, as I said, well, maybe wrong term, but or let be. You know, every time you do that, there is really a process of preparation for ultimate letting go. You know. So there's catches here that happen as part of our collective here that also, you could say, just like the maras, those are the hooks or catches in the negative. There's also what happens in the practice here itself. And traditionally, they're just known as, you know, the hindrances or the problems. And sometimes they're important. That we kind of explore and learn them, you know. And again, I went through desire there. I felt like I kind of touched on it, and you know the difference between pleasant sensation and desire. And another one is just, so you get caught by the wanting mind. You also get caught by the aversive mind, you know. And it seems like one of the lovely things in cultural conditioning is being not only inner critics, but outer critics, you know? And so we go around actually, you know, and here it's very interesting because everything is, you know, it's in silence stuff, but there is a lot going on, you know. Someone closes the door, and you think, you know, oh, they purposefully closed that door just when I got there. You know, it was so funny that way, you know. And you know, or I shouldn't have closed that door. That was terrible, you know. So we're always playing this game with ourselves about, and it's really is that kind of inner critic that's going around commenting on everything. And it gets out of hand, you know, and that's what aversion is. It gets out of hand, and there's a contraction, and actually I think it's much easier to identify in some ways because it's immediately painful. You know, where wanting is kind of like, oh, well, you know, maybe, you know. One of my teachers, oh, God, he was in that case, you know, but he was, you know, every morning we get up and we go into the hall and he'd say, and we had to kind of chant the Prajnaparamita and stuff, but he would say, life is like this. If you grab the head of the snake, it'll bite you. You know, so everybody goes, "Oh yeah, okay, that's good." You know, and he was kind of talking about the aversive side of it, anger, and he said, "But if you grab the tail of it, it still will bite you." You know, and it was just like, "Okay, here it is." You know, Okay, you can, you know, if it's aversive, you're going to grab it, it's going to bite you. And you think it's pleasant, you bite, and it's going to bite you later. You know? Yeah. Pretty simple stuff, you know. So we have aversion. Then we have, the whole, what is it? We kind of go into trances, kind of sleepiness and hypnagogic states. They refer to it as sloth and torpor. You know. And again, you know, with wanting, a lot of it is to see impermanence and to see actually the fact that they say that kind of exploring death, you know, kind of that yama-mara, it will kind of break some of the trance with the wanting mind. In the same way with the aversive mind, which is important because that's the kind of the hypercritic and the, judge. And that one is actually, its antidote is love. You know? So actually doing some metta when kind of it comes up and kind of catches you and holds you, you know. Sleepiness. First of all, I think when you first get here, I don't know, you know, one of the amazing things is the busyness of this culture, you know, and there's incredible amount of kind of tiredness or anxiousness, maybe it's screen something or other. I don't know. We're going to find a new thing in psychology for the, you know, this for screen stuff. I'm not sure yet if they've coined it, but we know it's happening. But there is a kind of, you could say, a kind of disembodiment and in it. And what's true is that, first of all, I totally think that, you know, when people come to retreats, they should sleep, you know. In the sense, instead of pushing right away, is kind of get yourself into balance. You know, and sometimes it takes a day, day and a half, whatever. Take a nap, you know, and you take care of yourself. But actually what I'm talking about, this sloth and torpor, is actually not about the physical tiredness. It's a lot about resistance, you know. And sometimes you have a story there, you have a, somebody done you this or that, and or you don't like your job, or you can't stand your relatives, or something, and you're actually resisting the actual truth of it. And what is the reaction to that? Boing! You kind of trance out, and even though you're not tired, then you kind of slump, you know, kind of fall over. And again, one of the things I like, you know, that it's this standing up practice is really great for that, by the way. Standing, taking a few deep breaths, opening your eyes. You know, they also say that one of the other antidotes is taking refuge in the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Sangha. That somehow the Dharma, there's an inspiration there. So you're bringing some kind of light. And they also say that sometimes visualizing light will energize you enough so that, you know, maybe you can attend to what it is that you're resisting. Yeah. So that's kind of the antidote to that. The fourth is traditionally it's talked about. First, there's two levels to this. One is called restlessness. And first of all, you know, sometimes you're there and you're kind of sleepy and you're kind of out of it. Other times, you know, boy, you can just get charged, you know. And it's a lot of it is, I'm not talking about mind so much as body, you know? And sometimes it just has its thing that it's doing, you know? In a way, sometimes I think, oh, the body's just trying to work something out, you know, in the restlessness. And they say that the restlessness is from karma from the past. Okay? I know you don't want to hear that. But anyway. that's what they say. You know? And so that's one side of it, though. But so that's really kind of the past influencing the body and the mind in the present. But there's also a thing called worry. You heard of it, this one, you know? And it comes along, and, you know, and it, what is worry? It's something about the future. And traditionally, it's you know, it is, you know, usually it's a couple phrases that, out of fear, that you repeat, and then you get on the train of association. And especially at 3 o'clock in the morning, you know, it's like, oh my God, you know, the world's going to come apart. It's not that it's true or not. It's just worry. It means that you're stepping into, in a sense, a fear state. And so again, in this particular case, you know, like they say with the restlessness, you know, you just have to kind of buckle up and die, you know. That's probably not right. But you know, you can sit there and kind of put more attention on concentration, and it's good. That was probably unskillful. but worry, you know, because it's just a string of words in the mind. It's something, it's, you know, it's like a broken record. It just kind of keeps going round and around. And actually, what you can do is, it's interesting because you can put your attention in your body, which is about here and now, and realize that what's based on is, where do I feel? Oh, you know, I may feel fear in my shoulders, my stomach, or my heart. Somewhere you will recognize the fear, you know. And those string of words that keep spinning around are not the thing itself, you know. And then, if you can connect with that, then it's actually quite skillful. Then there's a kind of releasing of it, you know? And you kind of come back into, oh, you know where I am? 3 o'clock in the morning, I'm in bed. You know, this is not a dream, but it is all a dream. No. so that's really, and the last one just go is a. is the most powerful one. And it is, there's kind of two levels to it. One is doubt, and it's doubt that, you know, I can stay here or do this. You know, so it's self-doubt, you know. And which, by the way, in this particular thing, if, when there's self-doubt about the practice, you know, maybe, you know, maybe you think, oh, maybe I should have a different teacher, maybe I should have be in a different retreat, and, you know, this isn't the right time for me. All those kind of things that you do, you know. And the thing is that the doubt, this whole process, is a process of actually, you know, it's sort of like sometimes I think it's like taking a cork and pushing it down. Of course, it pops back up again. But the thing is, we're trying to get underneath things. And when there's self-doubt there, and you doubt kind of what's going on here, the process or whatever, that you will stay on the surface. And this stuff actually won't work, you know. And a lot of times they say, oh, well, how if you have self-doubt, how do you get over that, you know, in some way? And sometimes it's, you know, reading a book, talking to a teacher, you know, it's kind of sticky because it says, no, I don't know if I trust this. You know? But it's not trust this. It's actually trusting yourself. And so there is kind of has to be a switch there of, in a way, kind of saying, well, it's okay. Maybe, I don't know this teacher, maybe I don't, this retreat, I'm not sure whether, and it's maybe not a good time. Ah, but who is it? No. And so one turns the mind around instead of projecting it out on timing and world and person and all that. One turns it back on oneself. And really, from the functional point of view of these practices, it's suddenly coming to this realization that somehow, you know, I'm enough. I'm enough just the way I am. You know? And it's a big statement. I'm enough just the way I am. I don't have to be somebody else. I don't have to have this right. You know? I just, you know, recognize that this is the reality or the situation. You know. And so the last of these things is really about, which is not a hindrance, but it's actually a very interesting phenomena that I see in the kind of Western paradigm of the seekers, the pilgrims. And that particularly is that, yes, we are a culture of doubters. And the doubters can be paralyzing, or it can be actually the investigation, the who am I? And that's really the question, and the big doubt is, who am I? You know, and if that's there, then one has already started the journey. You know, and we need that kind of the big doubt to get us kind of going. So ultimately, all these maras, these kind of problems, and actually, you can go farther into this stuff because it really deals with the shadow, you know, the things that the part that we don't see. And is somehow has influence on how and who we are. So in a way, we're here, in a sense, to unpack the maras and the, kind of these difficulties that are there, and the shadow material. And the reason is shadow, because you can't see it, right? But one of the truths here is simply by kind of sitting and getting to know the mind and the heart and the body, that we begin to, and it particularly kind of who we think we are, we begin to break those pieces apart. You know. It's not instant. The way our culture loves instant things, you know, brief therapy, brief this, brief that. But there isn't brief meditation, sorry to say. But the untangling that begins actually, in a sense, yes, we have to kind of be aware of these things, but there's something that's holding everything. And this is where I somewhat kind of with the Khandas Viskandas, that, you know, they are, in a sense, they're all based on the I, me, mine. And so it's a very relative kind of process. There's more than that. And so I jump from there into the fact that this is kind of a mysterious undertaking that we have been journeying along. And I go back to that awareness that it's not the consciousness that is like the candle that just keeps igniting itself. This is something that is knowable and has always been known, But it's always been sticky because it's caught with these kind of the selfing and these maras and these difficulties and these shadow pieces. And they are not all that there is. So all these practices is somehow to, you know, in a sense, it's kind of like no longer be fooled and begin to turn one's attention around and start relying more and more on what's known. You've never been separated from it. It's something that the problem is it sticks to things. And the ideals here are really, first you have to, in a sense, kind of watch how it all works, kind of study ourself so that we know, in a sense, how difficult it is to be and let go. But then at some point we have to reach a place where we're at ease enough and relaxed enough to recognize that there is something that's knowing right now. And again, it's not, you know, it's not something in, it's actually not in time. And it has the capacity, its greatest capacity is actually to free the dualism, the identity. And if we really get to realize that these maras and these difficulties and even the shadow material in a sense is powerless and if one realizes it's not sticking to things, then one also realizes that there is a space. And the space is, whether it's between thoughts, whether it's between sights, smells, tastes, through the sense doors of any kind, there's space. And then if there's no sticking, then there's really not a problem. One thing about that awareness is phenomenally kind. Why? Because fear is based in the dualism, not in the awareness itself. Which is a big thing. So it's actually, there is a sense of kindness or love that parallels it is kind of an open awareness, undisturbed awareness. So play with this, you know. You're going to get caught. That's what I was trying to give you, a little bit of map of getting caught. And I'm sorry about that. You know, but that's the way it is. And, you know, whether it's fogginess or sleepiness or restlessness or you just, you know, you doubt this whole stuff. And you get caught in, you know, in the inner critic. Hey, this ain't enough. I need more. No. So these are just, they're kind of self-entrapped. And I'm just saying, you're more than that. And you always have been more than that. But we get so caught and stuck by it. think that's enough. It's, you know, psychology of staying out of trouble, and the kind of precursor of freedom. Okay, let's just sit for a moment.